and has a central sun with radiating lines labeled Ur. Below it is the word Luvier, and to the lower left, a star and crescent moon marked Siv. The sail is sheeted back to the Taniquetil mountain. End of narrator's note. I give here a list of the names and words written on the drawing with, so far as possible, their meanings, but without any etymological detail, for which see the appendix on names, where names and words occurring only in this drawing are given separate entries. Ivene Kemen. This is clearly the title of the drawing. It might mean the shape of the earth or the vessel of the earth. See the appendix on names, entry Glorvent. Nume, west. Valinor, Taniquetil. The vast height of Taniquetil, even granting the formalization of this drawing, is noteworthy. It is described in the tale as being so high that the throngs about westward havens in the lands of men could be seen therefrom. Its fantastic height is conveyed in my father's painting, dating from 1927-8. Pictures by J.R.R. Tolkien, number 31. Harmalin, earlier name of Arvalin. Iallas, the trees standing to the west of Taniquetil. Toros Valinoriva. Toros is obscure, but in any case the first letter of the first word, if it is a T, is a very uncharacteristic one. The reference seems to be to the mountains of Valinor. Toli Kimpelear. These must be the Twilight Isles, but I have found no other occurrence of Kimpelear or anything similar. Tol Eresia, the Lonely Isle. Itoli Kuruvar, the Magic Isles. Haloisi Velike, the Great Sea. O, the sea. What is the structure at the sea bottom shown below the name O? It must surely be the dwelling of Ase beneath the Great Sea that is referred to in the next tale, The Chaining of Melko, Side 4. Inori Landar probably means the Great Lands. Kuivieneni, the precursor of Kuivienen, the Waters of Awakening. Palisor, the land where the elves awoke. Sil, moon. Ur, sun. Luvier, clouds. Oronto, east. Vaicha, Ilwe, and Vilna appear in the three layers described in the tale, and Vilna reappears in the bottom right-hand corner of the drawing. There is nothing said in the lost tales to explain this last feature, nor is it at all evident what is represented by the curled lines in the same place. Ulmonan, the halls of Ulmon. Uin, the great whale, who appears later in the tales. Vai, the outer ocean. Neni Erumea, outermost waters, equals Vai. It is seen from the drawing that the world floats in and upon Vai. This is indeed how Ulmo himself describes it to the Valar in a later tale, The Hiding of Valinor, Side 8. Lo, there is but one ocean, and that is Vai, for those that Ose esteemeth as oceans are but seas, waters that lie in the hollows of the rock. In this vast water floateth the wide earth, upheld by the word of Ilúvatar. In the same passage, Ulmo speaks of the islands in the seas and says that save some few that swim still unfettered, they stand now like pinnacles from their weedy depths, as is also well seen in the drawing. It might seem a plausible idea that there was some connection, physical as well as etymological, between Vai and Vaicha, the outermost of the three airs, wrapped dark and sluggish about the world and without it. At a later point in the tales, The Tale of the Sun and the Moon, Side 7, there is a reference to the dark and tenuous realm of Vaicha that is outside all. In the next phase of the mythical cosmology, dating from the 1930s and very clearly and fully documented and illustrated in a work called Ambarkanta, The Shape of the World, the whole world is contained within Vaya, a word meaning fold, envelope. Vaya is more like to sea below the earth and more like to air above the earth, which chimes with the description of the waters of Vai as very thin, so that no boat can sail on them nor fish swim in them, save the enchanted fish of Ulmo and his car, and in Vaya below the earth dwells Ulmo. Thus, Vaya is partly a development of Vaichya and partly of Vai. Now, since in the earliest word list of the Kenya tongue, see the appendix on names, both Vaichya, the outermost air beyond the world, and Vai, the outer ocean, are derived from a root Vaya, enfold, and since Vaichya in the present tale is said to be wrapped about the world and without it, one might think that Vaichya Vai already in the early cosmology was a continuous enfolding substance, and that the later cosmology in this point only makes explicit what was present but unexpressed in the lost tales. But there is certainly no actual suggestion of this idea in any early writing, and when we look again at the drawing, it seems untenable. For Vai is obviously not continuous with Vaichya, and if the appearance of Vilna in the bottom of the drawing is taken to mean that the earth and the ocean Vai in and on which it floats were contained within the three airs of which we see the reappearance of the innermost, Vilna, below the earth, and Vai, then the suggestion that Vaichya, Vai, were continuous is still more emphatically confounded. There remains the baffling question of the representation of the world as a ship. In only one place is there a suggestion that my father conceived the world in such a way, the passage that I have cited above, in which Ulmo addresses the Valar on the subject of Vai, concludes, "O Valar, ye know not all wonders, and many secret things are there beneath the earth's dark keel, even where I have my mighty halls of Ulmonan, that ye have never dreamed on." But in the drawing, Ulmonan is not beneath the ship's keel, it is within the ship's hull, and I am inclined to think that Ulmo's words, "beneath the earth's dark keel," refer to the shape of the earth itself, which is certainly ship-like. Moreover, close examination of the original drawing strongly suggests to me that the mast and sail, and still more clearly the curved prow, were added afterwards. Can it be that the shape of the earth and of Vai, as he had drawn them, with the appearance of a ship's hull, prompted my father to add mast, sail, and prow as a jeu d'esprit, without deeper significance? That seems uncharacteristic and unlikely, but I have no other explanation to offer. Footnote. If this is so, and if Iveni Kemen means the earth ship, then this title must have been added to the drawing at the same time as the mast, sail, and prow. In the little notebook referred to in the Cottage of Lost Play, side 1, there is an isolated note, "map of the ship of the world." End of footnote. 3. The lamps. In this part of the narrative, the tale differs remarkably from the later versions. Here there is no mention of the dwelling of the Valar on the isle of Almaren after the making of the lamps, the Silmarillion, page 35, nor, of course, of the return of Melko from outside, because here Melko not only did not leave the world after entering it, but actually himself made the pillars of the lamps. In this story, though Melko was distrusted by some, his guileful cooperation, even to the extent of contributing names for the pillars, was accepted, whereas in the later story his hostility and malice were known and manifest to the Valar, even though they did not know of his return to Arda and the building of Utumno until too late. In the present tale there is a tricksiness, a low cunning in Melko's behaviour that could not survive, yet the story of his deceitful making of the pillars out of ice survived into the versions of the 1930s. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 4. The Book of Lost Tales, Part 1, continuing with the coming of the Valar and the building of Valinor, on page 87. Later, it was the lamps themselves that were named. Ultimately, after intervening forms had been devised and discarded, Iluin, the northern lamp, and Ormal, the southern. In the Silmarillion, Rengil, containing Ring, cold, survived only as the name of Fingolfin's sword, but Helkar is that of the inland sea, which stood where aforetime the roots of the mountain of Iluin had been, page 49. In the present tale, Helkar was the name of the southern, not the northern pillar. Now, Helkar meant utter cold, see the appendix on names, which shows that Helkar was originally in the extreme south, as it is in one of the two positions given for it on the little map, just as Hringil was in the extreme north. In the tale there is no mention of the formation of inland seas at the fall of the lamps. This idea appeared later, but it seems virtually certain that it arose from the story of the melting pillars of ice. There is no later reference to the building of the mountains of Valinor from great rocks gathered in Eruman, Arvalin, so that the region became flat and stoneless. 4. The Two Trees. This earliest account of the uprising of the two trees illuminates some elements of later versions more concentrated in expression. The enduring feature that the ground beneath Silpion, Telperion, was dappled with the shadows of his fluttering leaves, the Silmarillion, page 38, is seen to have had its origin in the throbbing of the tree's heart. The conception of light as a liquid substance that splashed upon the ground, that ran in rivers and was poured in cauldrons, though not lost in the published work, pages 38-9, is here more strongly and physically expressed. Some features were never changed, as the clustered flowers of Laurelin and the shining edges of its leaves. On the other hand, there are notable differences between this and the later accounts, above all perhaps that Laurelin was in origin the Eldar tree. The two trees had here periods of 12 hours, not as later, 7. Footnote, Palurian's words, "This tree, when the 12 hours of its fullest light are past, will wane again," seem to imply a longer space than 12 hours, but probably the period of waning was not allowed for. In an annotated list of names to the tale of the fall of Gondolin, it is said that Silpion lit all Valinor with silver light for half the 24 hours. End of footnote. And the preparations of the Valar for the birth of the trees, with all their detail of physical magic, were afterwards abandoned. The two great cauldrons, Cululin and Cylindrin, survived in the great vats like shining lakes in which Varda hoarded the dews of Telperion and the rain that fell from Laurelin, the Silmarillion, page 39, though the names disappeared, as did the need to water the trees with the light gathered in the vats or cauldrons, or at any rate it is not mentioned later. Urwen, Sun Maiden, was the forebear of Arjen, Maya of the Sun, and Gilion, steersman of the moon in the Silmarillion, who lay in dreams by the pools of Este, Lorien's wife, in Telperion's flickering beams, perhaps owes something to the figure of Silmo, whom Lorien loved. As I noted earlier, in the later evolution of the myths, Vana sank down in relation to Nienna, and here it is Vana and Yavanna, Palurien, who are the midwives of the birth of the trees, not as afterwards Yavanna and Nienna. As regards the names of the trees, Silpion was for long the name of the white tree. Telperion did not appear till long after, and even then Silpion was retained and is mentioned in the Silmarillion, page 38, as one of its names. Laurelin goes back to the beginning and was never changed, but its other name in the Lost Tales, Lindaloxe, and other similar forms, was not retained. 5. The Dwellings of the Valar. This account of the mansions of the Valar was very largely lost in the subsequent versions. In the published work, nothing is told of Manwë's dwelling, save the bare fact that his halls were above the everlasting snow upon Oyolose, the uttermost tower of Taniquetil, page 26. Here now appears Sorontur, king of eagles, a visitor to Manwë's halls, compare the Silmarillion, page 110, for Manwë, to whom all birds are dear, and to whom they bring news upon Taniquetil from Middle-earth, had sent forth the race of eagles. He had, in fact, appeared already in the tale of the fall of Gondolin as Thorndor, the gnomish name, king of eagles, whom the Eldar name Ramandur, Ramandur being subsequently emended to Sorontur. Of Valmar and the dwellings of the Valar in the city, Scarcely anything survived in later writing, and there remain only phrases here and there, the golden streets and silver domes of Valmar, Valmar of many bells, to suggest the solidity of the original description, where Tulkas's house of many stories had a tower of bronze, and Orome's halls were upheld by living trees with trophies and antlers hung upon their trunks. This is not to say that all such imagining was definitively abandoned. As I have said in the foreword, the lost tales were followed by a version so compressed as to be no more than a resume, as was its purpose, and the later development of the mythology proceeded from that, a process of re-expansion. Many things never referred to again after the lost tales may have continued to exist in a state of suspension, as it were. Valmar certainly remained a city, with gates, streets, and dwellings. But in the context of the later work, one could hardly conceive of the tempestuous Ossé being possessed of a house in Valmar, even if its floor were of seawater and its roof of foam. And, of course, the hall of Makar and Mease, where the life described owes something to the myths of the unending battle in ancient Scandinavia, disappeared with the disappearance of those divinities, a Melko faction in Valinor that was bound to prove an embarrassment. Several features of the original descriptions endured. The rarity of Ulmer's visits to Valmar, compare the Silmarillion, page 40, the frequency with which Palurien and Orome visit the world without, the same place, pages 29, 41, 47, the association of the gardens of Lorien with Silpion, and of the gardens of Vana with Laurelin, the same place, page 99, and much that is said here of the divine characters can be seen to have remained, even if differently expressed. Here also appears Nessa, already as the wife of Tulkas and the sister of Orome, excelling in the dance. And Omar Amilo is now named the brother of Noldorin Salmar. It appears elsewhere, see page 93, that Mieliqui was the daughter of Orome and Vana. 6. The gods of death and the fates of elves and men. This section of the tale contains its most surprising and difficult elements. Mandos and his wife Nienna appear in the account of the coming of the Valar into the world at the beginning of the tale, where they are named Fantur of Death, Vefantur Mandos, and Fui Nienna, Mistress of Death. In the present passage, it is said that Vefantur named his dwelling Ve by his own name, whereas afterwards, the Silmarillion, page 28, he was called by the name of his dwelling, but in the early writing there is a distinction between the region, Mandos, and the halls, Ve and Fui, within the region. There is here no trace of Mandos as the doomsman of the Valar, who pronounces his dooms and his judgments only at the bidding of Manwë, one of the most notable aspects of the later conception of this Valar, nor, since Nienna is the wife of Mandos, has Vaire the Weaver, his wife in the later story, appeared with her tapestries that portray all things that have ever been in time and clothe the halls of Mandos that ever widen as the ages pass. In the Lost Tales, the name Vaire is given to an elf of Tolaresia. Tapestries picturing those things that were and shall be are found here in the halls of Aule. Most important in the passage concerning Mandos is the clear statement about the fate of elves who die, that they wait in the halls of Mandos until Vefantur decrees their release to be reborn in their own children. This latter idea has already appeared in the tale of the Music of the Ainur, side 3, and it remained my father's unchanged conception of elvish immortality for many years. Indeed, the idea that the elves might die only from the wounds of weapons or from grief was never changed. It also has appeared in the Music of the Ainur, side 3. The Eldar dwell till the great end, unless they be slain or waste in grief, a passage that survived with little alteration in the Silmarillion, page 42. With the account of Fui Nienna, however, we come upon ideas in deep contradiction to the central thought of the later mythology, and in this passage also there is a strain of another kind of mythic conception in the conceits of the distilling of salt humours whereof are tears, and of the black clouds woven by Niana, which settle on the world as despairs and hopeless mourning, sorrows and blind grief. Here we learn that Niana is the judge of men in her halls, named Fui after her own name, and some she keeps in the region of Mandos, where is her hall, while the greater number board the black ship Mornie, which does no more than ferry these dead down the coast to Arvalin, where they wander in the dusk until the end of the world. But yet others are driven forth to be seized by Melko and taken to endure evil days in Angamandi. In what sense are they dead or mortal? And most extraordinary of all, there are a very few who go to dwell among the gods in Valinor. We are far away here from the gift of Ilúvatar, whereby men are not bound to the world, but leave it none know where. And this is the true meaning of death, for the death of the elves is a seeming death, the Silmarillion, page 42, the final and inescapable exit. Footnote. Men are not bound to the world, but leave it none know where. Compare the Silmarillion, page 104. Some say that they, men, too, go to the halls of Mandos, but their place of waiting there is not that of the elves, and Mandos under Ilúvatar alone, save Manwë, knows whither they go after the time of recollection in those silent halls beside the outer sea. Also, in the same place, page 186, for the spirit of Beren at her bidding tarried in the halls of Mandos, unwilling to leave the world, until Lúthien came to say her last farewell upon the dim shores of the outer sea, whence men that die set out never to return. End of footnote. But a little illumination, if of a very misty kind, can be shed on the idea of men after death wandering in the dusk of Arvalin, where they camp as they may, and wait in patience till the great end. I must refer here to the details of the changed names of this region, which have been given. It is clear, from the early word lists or dictionaries of the two languages, for which see the appendix on names, that the meaning of Harwalin and Arvalin, and probably Habbanan also, was nigh Valinor, or nigh the Valar. From the Gnomish dictionary, it emerges that the meaning of Eruman was beyond the abode of the Manir, i.e., south of Tenequitil, where dwelt Manwë's spirits of the air, and this dictionary also makes it clear that the word Manir was related to Gnomish Manos, defined as a spirit that has gone to the Valar or to Erumani, and Mani, good, holy. The significance of these etymological connections is very unclear. But there is also a very early poem on the subject of this region. This, according to my father's notes, was written at Brockton Camp, Staffordshire, in December 1915, or at Etaples in June 1916, and it is entitled Habbanan Beneath the Stars. In one of the three texts, in which there are no variants, there is a title in Old English, Tha Geblitsoda, Blessed, Felda und Tham Steorum, and in two of them, Habbanan in the title was emended to Eruman. In the third, Eruman stood from the first. The poem is preceded by a short prose preamble. Habbanan Beneath the Stars. Now, Habbanan is that region where one draws nigh to the places that are not of men. There is the air very sweet, and the sky very great, by reason of the broadness of the earth. In Habbanan beneath the skies, where all roads end, however long, there is a sound of faint guitars and distant echoes of a song, for there men gather into rings round their red fires while one voice sings, and all about is night. Not night as ours, unhappy folk, where nigh the earth in hazy bars, a mist about the springing of the stars, their trails a thin and wandering smoke, obscuring with its veil half seen, the great abysmal still serene. A globe of dark glass faceted with light, wherein the splendid winds have dusky flight, untrodden spaces of an odorous plain, that watches for the moon that long has lain, and caught the meteor's fiery rain. Such there is night. There on a sudden did my heart perceive that they who sang about the eve who answered the bright shining stars with gleaming music of their strange guitars, these were his wandering happy sons, encamped upon those airy leas, where God's unsullied garment runs in glory down his mighty knees. A final evidence comes from the early Kenya word list. The original layer of entries in this list dates, as I believe, see the appendix on names, from 1915, and among these original entries, under a root mana, from which manwe is derived, is given a word manimo, which means a soul who is in manimuine, purgatory. This poem and this entry in the word list offer a rare and very suggestive glimpse of the mythic conception in its earliest phase, for here ideas that are drawn from Christian theology are explicitly present. It is disconcerting to perceive that they are still present in this tale, for in the tale there is an account of the fates of dead men after judgment in the black hall of Fuiniena. Some, and these are the many, are ferried by the death ship to Habanan, Eruman, where they wander in the dusk and wait in patience till the great end. Some are seized by Melko and tormented in Angamandi, the hells of Arn, and some few go to dwell with the gods in Valinor. Taken with the poem and the evidence of the early dictionaries, can this be other than a reflection of purgatory, hell, and heaven? This becomes all the more extraordinary if we refer to the concluding passage of the tale of the music of the Ainur, side 2, where Ilúvatar said, "To men I will give a new gift and a greater, the gift that they might fashion and design their life beyond even the original music of the Ainur, that is, as fate to all things else, and where it is said that it is one with this gift of power that the children of men dwell only for a short time in the world alive, yet do not perish utterly forever." In the final form, given in the Silmarillion, pages 41 to 2, this passage was not very greatly changed. The early version does not, it is true, have the sentences, "But the sons of men die indeed and leave the world, wherefore they are called the guests or the strangers. Death is their fate, the gift of Ilúvatar, which as time wears even the powers shall envy." Even so, it seems clear that this central idea, the gift of death, was already present. This matter I must leave as a conundrum that I cannot solve. The most obvious explanation of the conflict of ideas within these tales would be to suppose the music of the Ainur later than the coming of the Valar and the building of Valinor, but as I have said, the music of the Ainur, side 3, all the appearances are to the contrary. Lastly, may be noticed the characteristic linguistic irony whereby Eruman ultimately became Araman, for Arvalin meant simply near Valinor, and it was the other name, Eruman, that had associations with spirits of the dead, but Araman almost certainly simply means beside Aman, and yet the same element, man, good, remained, for Aman was derived from it, the unmarred state. Two minor matters in the conclusion of the tale remain to be noticed. Here, Nornore is the herald of the gods. Afterwards, this was Fionwe, later Eonwe. See the music of the Ainur, side 3. And in the reference to that low place amid the hills where Valinor may just be glimpsed near to Taniquetil, we have the first mention of the gap in the mountains of Valinor, where was the hill of the city of the elves. On blank pages near the end of the text of this tale, my father wrote a list of secondary names of the Valar, as Manwe, Sulimo, etc. Some of these names appear in the text of the tales. Those that do not are given in the appendix on names under the primary names. It emerges from this list that Omar Amillo is the twin of Salmar Noldorin. They are named as brothers in the tale. That Nialikwi is the daughter of Orome and Vanna, and that Melko has a son by Ulbandi called Kosomot. This, it will later emerge, was Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, whom Ectalion slew in Gondolin. 4. The Chaining of Melko. Introduction. Following the end of Rumil's tale of the coming of the Valar and the building of Valinor, There is a long interlude before the next one, though the manuscript continues without even interrupting the paragraph. But on the cover of the notebook, The Chaining of Melko is given as a separate title, and I have adopted this. The text continues in ink over an erased pencil manuscript. That night, Ariel heard again in his sleep the music that had so moved him on the first night, and the next morning he went again into the gardens early. There he met Vire, and she called him Ariel. That was the first making and uttering of that name. Ariel told Vire of the dream music he had heard, and she said that it was no dream music, but rather the flute of Timpinen, whom those gnomes, Rumil and Little Heart and others of my house call Tinfang. She told him that the children called him Tinfang Warble, and that he played and danced in summer dusks for joy of the first stars. At every note a new one sparkles forth and glisters. The Nololi say that they come out too soon if Tinfang Warble plays, and they love him, and the children will watch often from the windows, lest he tread the shadowy lawns unseen. She told Ariel that he was shyer than a fawn, swift to hide and dart away as any vole, a footstep on a twig, and he is away, and his fluting will come mocking from afar. The Chaining of Melko. And a marvel of wizardry liveth in that fluting, said Ariel, if that it be indeed, which I have heard now for two nights here. There be none, said Vire, not even of the Solus Impi, who can rival him therein, albeit those same pipers claim him as their kin. Yet 'tis said everywhere that this quaint spirit is neither wholly of the Valar nor of the Eldar, but is half a fay of the woods and dells, one of the great companies of the children of Pelurian, and half a gnome or a shoreland piper, note one. Howso that be, he is a wondrous wise and strange creature, and he fared hither away with the Eldar long ago, marching or resting among them, but going always ahead, piping strangely, or whiles sitting aloof. Now does he play about the gardens of the land, but Alal Minore he loves the best, and this garden best of all. Ever and again we miss his piping for long months, and we say Tinfang Warble has gone heartbreaking in the great land, and many a one in those far regions will hear his piping in the dusk outside tonight. But on a sudden will his flute be heard again at an hour of gentle gloaming, or will he play beneath a goodly moon, and the stars go bright and blue? Aye, said Ariel, and the hearts of those that hear him go beating with a quickened longing. Meseemed 'twas my desire to open the window and leap forth, so sweet was the air that came to me from without. Nor might I drink deep enough, but as I listened, I wished to follow I know not whom, I know not whither, out into the magic of the world beneath the stars. Then of a sooth 'twas Timpinen who played to you, said Vire, and honoured are you, for this garden has been empty of his melody many a night. Now, however, for such is the eeriness of that sprite, you will ever love the evenings of summer and the nights of stars, and their magic will cause your heart to ache unquenchably. But have you not all heard him many times and often that dwell here, said Ariel? Yet do not seem to me like those who live with a longing that is half understood and may not be fulfilled. Nor do we so, for we have Limpe, said she, Limpe that alone can cure, and a draught of it giveth a heart to fathom all music and song. Then, said Ariel, would I might drain a goblet of that good drink. But Vare told him that that might only be if he sought out Meryl the queen. Of this converse of Ariel and Vire upon the lawn that fair daytide, came it that Ariel set out, not many days thereafter, and Tinfang Warble had played to him many times by dusk, by starry light and moon gleam, till his heart was full. In that was Little Heart his guide, and he sought the dwellings of Merrily Turinki in her corin of elms. Now the house of that fair lady was in that very city, for at the foot of the great tower which Ingil had built was a wide grove of the most ancient and beautiful elms that all that land of elms possessed. High to heaven they rose, in three lessening stories of bright foliage, and the sunlight that filtered through was very cool, a golden green. Amidst of these was a great green sward of grass, smooth as a web of stuffs, and about it those trees stood in a circle, so that shades were heavy at its edge, but the gaze of the sun fell all day on its middle. There stood a beautiful house, and it was builded all of white, and of a whiteness that shone, but its roof was so o'ergrown with mosses and with house-leek, and many curious clinging plants, that of what it was once fashioned might not be seen for the glorious maze of colours, golds and red russets, scarlets and greens. Innumerable birds chattered in its eaves, and some sang upon the housetops, while doves and pigeons circled in flights about the corin's borders, or swooped to settle and sun upon the sward. Now all that dwelling was footed in flowers. Blossomy clusters were about it, ropes and tangles, spikes and tassels all in bloom, flowers in panicles and umbels, or with great wide faces gazing at the sun. There did they loose upon the faintly stirring airs their several odours, blended to a great fragrance of exceeding marvellous enchantment, but their hues and colours were scattered and gathered seemingly as chance, and the happiness of their growth directed them. All day long there went a hum of bees among those flowers. Bees fared about the roof, and all the scented beds and ways, even about the cool porches of the house. Now Little Heart and Ariel climbed the hill, and it was late afternoon, and the sun shone brazen upon the western side of Ingil's tower. Soon came they to a mighty wall of hewn stone blocks, and this leaned outward, but grasses grew atop of it, and harebells and yellow daisies. A wicket they found in the wall, and beyond was a glade beneath the elms, and there ran a pathway bordered of one side with bushes, while of the other flowed a little running water, whispering over a brown bed of leafy mould. This led even to the sward's edge, and coming thither, said Little Heart, pointing to that white house, "Behold the dwelling of Merrily Turinki, and as I have no errand with so great a lady, I will get me back again." Then Ariel went over the sunny lawn alone, until he was nigh shoulder high in the tall flowers that grew before the porches of the door. And as he drew near, a sound of music came to him, and a fair lady amid many maidens stepped forth, as it were, to meet him. Then said she, smiling, "Welcome, O mariner of many seas! Wherefore do you seek the pleasure of my quiet gardens and their gentle noise, when the salt breezes of the sea and the snuff of winds and a swaying boat should rather be your joy?" For a while Ariel might say naught thereto, being tongue-tied by the beauty of that lady and the loveliness of that place of flowers. Yet at length he muttered that he had known sea enough, but of this most gracious land he might never be sated. "Nay," said she, "on a day of autumn will come the winds, and a driven gull, maybe, will wail overhead, and lo, you will be filled with desire, remembering the black coasts of your home." Note 2. "Nay, lady," said Ariel, and now he spoke with eager voice, "nay, not so, for the spirit that flutes upon twilight lawns has filled my heart with music, and I thirst for a draught of limpet." Then straightway did the smiling face of Meryl grow grave, and bidding her maidens depart, she prayed Ariel follow her to a space nigh to the house, and this was of cool grass, but not very short. Fruit trees grew there, and about the roots of one, an apple tree of great girth and age, the soil was piled, so that there was now a broad seat around its bole, soft and grass-covered. There sat Meryl, and she gazed upon Ariel, and said, "Know you, then, what it is that you ask?" And he said, "I know not, save that I desire to know the soul of every song, and of all music, and to dwell always in fellowship and kinship with this wondrous people of the Eldar of the Isle, and to be free of unquenchable longing, even till the faring forth, even till the great end." But Meryl said, "Fellowship is possible, maybe, but kinship not so, for man is man, and Eldar, Eldar, and what Ilúvatar has made unalike may not become alike while the world remain. Even didst thou dwell here till the great end, and for the health of Limpe found no death, Yet then must thou die and leave us, for man must die once. And hearken, O Ariel, think not to escape unquenchable longing with a draught of limpe, for only wouldst thou thus exchange desires, replacing thy old ones with new and deeper and more keen. Desire unsatisfied dwells in the hearts of both those races that are called the children of Ilúvatar, but with the Eldar most, for their hearts are filled with a vision of beauty and great glory. Yet, O Queen, said Ariel thereto, let me but taste of this drink, and become an age-long fellow of your people. O Queen of the Eldalie, that I may be as the happy children of Marvanwachalieva. Nay, not yet can I do that, said Merrill, for it is a graver matter far to give this drink to one who has known life and days already in the lands of men, than for a child to drink who knows but little else. Yet even these did we keep a long while ere we gave them the wine of song, teaching them first much lore, and testing their hearts and souls. Therefore I bid you now bide still longer, and learn all that you may in this our isle. Lo, what do you know of the world, or of the ancient days of men, or of the roots which those things that now are have far back in time, or what of the Eldalie and all their wisdom, that you should claim our cup of youth and poesy? The tongue of Tolaresia do I know, and of the Valar have I heard, and the great world's beginning, and the building of Valinor. To musics have I hearkened, and to poesy and the laughter of the elves, and all I have found true and good, and my heart knows, and it saith to me, that these shall I always henceforth love, and love alone. Thus answered Ariel, and his heart was sore for the refusal of the queen. Yet nothing do you know of the coming of the elves, of the fates wherein they move, nor their nature and the place that Ilúvatar has given to them. Little do you reck of that great splendour of their home in Eldamar, upon the hill of Kor, nor all the sorrow of our parting. What know you of our travail down all the dark ways of the world, and the anguish we have known because of Melko? Of the sorrows we have suffered, and do yet because of men? Of all the fears that darken our hopes because of men? Know you the wastes of tears that lie between our life in Tolaresia and that time of laughter that we knew in Valinor? O child of men, who wouldst be sharer of the fates of the Eldalie, what of our high desires, and all those things we look for still to be? For lo, if you drink this drink, all these must you know and love. Having one heart with us, nay, even at the faring forth, should Eldar and men fall into war at the last, still must you stand by us, against the children of your kith and kin. But until then, never may you fare away home, though longings gnaw you, and the desires that at whiles consume a full-grown man who drinketh limpe are a fire of unimagined torture. Knew you these things, O Ariel, when you fared hither with your request? Nay, I knew them not, said Ariel sadly, though often have I questioned folk thereof. Then lo, said Merrill, I will begin a tale, and tell you some of it ere the long afternoon grows dim, but then must you fare hence again in patience. And Ariel bowed his head. Then, said Merrill, now I will tell you of a time of peace the world once knew, and it is known as Melko's Chain. Built, and the gods dwell in peace, for Melko is far in the world, delving deep, and fortifying himself in iron and cold. But Makar and Mease ride upon the gales, and rejoice in earthquakes, and the overmastering furies of the ancient seas. Light and beautiful is Valinor, but there is a deep twilight upon the world, for the gods have gathered so much of that light that had before flowed about the airs. Seldom now falls the shimmering rain as it was used, and there reigns a gloom lit with pale streaks, or shot with red where Melko spouts to heaven from a fire-torn hill. Then Palurian Yavanna fared forth from her fruitful gardens to survey the wide lands of her domain, and wandered the dark continents, sowing seed and brooding upon hill and dale. Alone in that age-long gloaming, she sang songs of the utmost enchantment, and of such deep magic were they that they floated about the rocky places, and their echoes lingered for years of time in hill and empty plain, and all the good magics of all later days are whispers of the memories of her echoing song. Then things began to grow there. Fungus and strange growths heaved in damp places, and lichens and mosses crept stealthily across the rocks and ate their faces, and they crumbled and made dust, and the creeping plants died in the dust, and there was mould, and ferns and watered plants grew in it silently, and strange creatures thrust their heads from crannies and crept over the stones. But Yavanna wept, for this was not the fair vigor that she had thought of, and thereupon Orome came to her leaping in the dusk, but Tuivana would not leave the radiance of Kolulin, nor Nessa the green swards of her dancing. Then Orome and Palurian put forth all their might, and Orome blew great blasts upon his horn, as though he would awake the grey rocks to life and lustihead. Behold, at these blasts the great forest reared and moaned about the hills, and all the trees of dark leaf came to being, and the world was shaggy with the growth of pines, and odorous with resinous trees, and firs and cedars hung their blue and olive draperies about the slopes, and yews began the centuries of their growth. Now was Orome less gloomy, and Pelurian was comforted, seeing the beauty of the first stars of Varda gleaming in the pale heavens through the shadows of the first tree's boughs, and hearing the murmur of the dusky forests and the creaking of the branches when Manwe stirred the airs. At that time did many strange spirits fare into the world, for there were pleasant places, dark and quiet, for them to dwell in. Some came from Mandos, aged spirits that journeyed from Iluvatar with him who are older than the world and very gloomy and secret, and some from the fortresses of the north where Melko then dwelt, in the deep dungeons of Itumna. Full of evil and unwholesome were they, luring and restlessness and horror they brought, turning the dark into an ill and fearful thing, which it was not before. But some few danced thither with gentle feet, exuding evening scents, and these came from the gardens of Lorien. Still is the world full of these in the days of light, lingering alone in shadowy hearts of primeval forests, calling secret things across a starry waste, and haunting caverns in the hills that few have found. But the pine woods are yet too full of these old, unelfin and inhuman spirits for the quietude of Eldar or of men. When this great deed was done, then Palurian would fain rest from her long labours and return to taste the sweet fruits of Valinor, and be refreshed beneath the tree of Laurelin, whose dew is light, and Orome was for beechwoods on the plains of the great gods. But Melko, who long time had delved in fear because of the wrath of the Valar at his treacherous dealing with their lamps, burst forth now into a great violence, for he had thought the world abandoned by the gods to him and his. Beneath the very floors of Asse he caused the earth to quake and split, and his lower fires to mingle with the sea. Vaporous storms and a great roaring of uncontrolled sea motions burst upon the world, and the forests groaned and snapped. The sea leapt upon the land and tore it, and wide regions sank beneath its rage or were hewn into scattered islets, and the coast was dug into caverns. The mountains rocked and their hearts melted, and stone poured like liquid fire down their ashen sides, and flowed even to the sea, and the noise of the great battles of the fiery beaches came roaring even through the mountains of Valinor, and drowned the singing of the gods. Then rose Kemi Palurian, even Yavanna that giveth fruits, and Aule who loveth all her works and the substances of the earth, and they climbed to the halls of Manwe and spake to him, saying that all that goodliness was going utterly to wreck for the fiery evil of Melko's untempered heart. And Yavanna pleaded that all her age-long labour in the twilight be not drowned and buried. Thither, as they spake, came Osse, raging like a tide among the cliffs, for he was wroth at the upheaval of his realm, and feared the displeasure of Ulmo, his overlord. Then arose Manwë Sulimo, lord of gods and elves, and Varda Tinwatari was beside him, and he spake in a voice of thunder from Taniquetil, and the gods in Valmar heard it, and Vefantur knew the voice in Mandos, and Lórien was aroused in Murmuran. Then was a great council held between the two trees at the mingling of the lights, and Ulmo came thither from the outer deeps. And of the reeds there spoken, the gods devised a plan of wisdom, and the thought of Ulmo was therein, and much of the craft of Aule, and the wide knowledge of Manwë. Behold, Aule now gathered 6 metals, copper, silver, tin, lead, iron, and gold, and taking a portion of each, made with his magic a 7th, which he named, therefore, Tilkal, and this had all the properties of the 6, and many of its own. Footnote in the manuscript, Tambe, Ilsa, Latuken, Kanu, Anga, Laure. Narrator's note, the initial letters of these make up the word Tilkal. End of narrator's note. Ilsa and Laure are the magic names of ordinary Telpe and Kulu. End of note. Its color was bright green or red in varying lights, and it could not be broken, and Aule alone could forge it. Thereafter he forged a mighty chain, making it of all 7 metals welded with spells to a substance of uttermost hardness and brightness and smoothness. But of Tilkal he had not sufficient to add more than a little to each link. Nonetheless, he made 2 manacles of Tilkal only, and 4 fetters likewise. Now the chain was named Angaino, the oppressor, and the manacles Vorotemna, that bind forever, but the fetters Ilterendi, for they might not be filed or cleft. But the desire of the gods was to seek out Melko with great power, and to entreat him, if it might be, to better deeds. Yet did they purpose, if naught else availed, to overcome him by force or guile, and set him in a bondage from which there should be no escape. Now, as Aule smithied, the gods arrayed themselves in armour which they had of Makar, and he was fain to see them putting on weapons and going as to war, howso their wrath be directed against Melko. But when the great gods and all their folk were armed, then Manwë climbed into his blue chariot, whose 3 horses were the whitest that roamed in Orome's domain, and his hand bore a great white bow that would shoot an arrow like a gust of wind across the widest seas. Fionnwë his son stood behind him, and Nornore, who was his herald, ran before. But Orome rode alone upon a chestnut horse, and had a spear, and Tulkas strode mightily beside his stirrup, having a tunic of hide, and a brazen belt, and no weapon save a gauntlet upon his right hand, iron-bound. Telemektar his son, but just war-high, was by his shoulder, with a long sword girt about his waist by a silver girdle. There rode the Fanturi upon a car of black, and there was a black horse upon the side of Mandos, and a dappled grey upon the side of Lórien, and Salmar and Omar came behind, running speedily, but Aule, who was late, tarrying over long at his smithy, came last, and he was not armed, but caught up his long-handled hammer as he left his forge, and fared hastily to the borders of the shadowy sea, and the fathoms of his chain were borne behind by 4 of his smithy folk. Upon those shores, Falman Osse met them, and drew them across on a mighty raft, whereon he himself sat in shimmering mail. But Ulmo Vailimo was far ahead, roaring in his deep-sea car, and trumpeting in wrath upon a horn of conches. Thus was it that the gods got them over the sea and through the isles, and set foot upon the wide lands, and marched in great power and anger evermore to the north. Thus they passed the mountains of Iron and Hisilome that lies dim beyond, and came to the rivers and hills of ice. There Melko shook the earth beneath them, and he made snow-capped heights to belch forth flame. Yet for the greatness of their array, his vassals who infested all their ways availed nothing to hinder them on their journey. There in the deepest north, beyond even the shattered pillar Ringil, they came upon the huge gates of deep Utumna, and Melko shot them with great clangor before their faces. Then Tulkas, angered, smote them thunderously with his great fist, and they rang and stirred not. But Orome, alighting, grasped his horn and blew such a blast thereon that they fled open instantly, and Manwe raised his immeasurable voice and bade Melko come forth. But though deep down within those halls Melko heard him and was in doubt, he would not come, but sent Langon, his servant, and said by him that, behold, he was rejoiced and in wonder to see the gods before his gates. Now would he gladly welcome them, yet for the poverty of his abode, not more than two of them could he fitly entertain, and he begged that neither Manwe nor Tulkas be of the two, for the one merited and the other demanded hospitality of great cost and richness. Should this not be to their mind, then would he fain hearken to Manwe's herald, and learn what it were the gods so greatly desired, that they must leave their soft couches and indolence of Valinor for the bleak places where Melko laboured humbly and did his toilsome work. Then Manwe and Ulmo and all the gods were exceeding wroth at his subtlety and fawning insolence of his words, and Tulkas would have started straightway raging down the narrow stairs that descended out of sight beyond the gates, but the others withheld him, and Aule gave counsel that it was clear from Melko's words that he was awake and wary in this matter, and it could most plainly be seen which of the gods he was most in fear of, and desired least to see standing in his halls. Therefore, said he, let us devise how these twain may come upon him unawares, and how fear may perchance drive him into betterment of ways. To this Manwe assented, saying that all their force might scarce dig Melko from his stronghold, whereas that deceit must be very cunningly woven that would ensnare the master of guile. Only by his pride is Melko assailable, quoth Manwe, or by such a struggle as would rend the earth and bring evil upon us all. And Manwe sought to avoid all strife twixt Ainur and Ainur. When therefore the gods had concerted a plan to catch Melko in his overweening pride, they wove cunning words, purporting to come from Manwe himself, and these they put in the mouth of Nornore, who descended and spoke them before the seat of Melko. Behold, said he, the gods be come to ask the pardon of Melko, for seeing his great anger and the rending of the world beneath his rage, they have said one to another, lo, wherefore is Melko displeased? And one to another have answered, beholding the tumults of his power, is he not then the greatest among us? Why dwells not the mightiest of the Valar in Valinor? Of a surety he has cause for indignation. Let us get us to Utumna and beseech him to dwell in Valinor, that Valmar be not empty of his presence. To this, said he, Tulkas alone would not assent, but Manwe bowed to the common voice. This the gods said, knowing the rancor that Melko had for Poldoria. And now have they come constraining Tulkas with violence, to beg thee to pardon them each one, and to fare home with them, and complete their glory, dwelling, if it be thy pleasure, in the halls of Makar, until such time as Aule can build thee a great house, and its towers shall overtop Taniquetil. To this did Melko answer eagerly, for already his boundless pride surged up and drowned his cunning. At last do the gods speak fair words and just, but ere I grant their boon, my heart must be appeased for old affronts. Therefore must they come, putting aside their weapons at the gate, and do homage to me in these my deep halls of Utumna. But lo, Tulkas I will not see, and if I come to Valinor, then will I thrust him out. These things did Nornore report, and Tulkas smote his hands in wrath. But Manwe returned answer that the gods would do as Melko's heart desired. Yet would Tulkas come, and that in chains, and be given to Melko's power and pleasure. And this was Melko eager to grant, for the humiliation of the Valar, and the chaining of Tulkas gave him great mirth. Then the Valar laid aside their weapons at the gate, setting, however, folk to guard them, and placed the chain Angino about the neck and arms of Tulkas, and even he might scarce support its great weight alone. And now they follow Manwe and his herald into the caverns of the north. There sat Melko in his chair, and that chamber was lit with flaming braziers and full of evil magic, and strange shapes moved with feverish movement in and out, but snakes of great size curled and uncurled without rest about the pillars that upheld that lofty roof. Then said Manwe, "Behold, we have come and salute you here in your own halls. Come now and be in Valinor." But Melko might not thus easily forego his sport. "Nay, first," said he, "wilt thou come, Manwe, and kneel before me, and after you all the Valar, but last shall come Tulkas and kiss my foot, for I have in mind something for which I owe Poldoria no great love." Now he purposed to spurn Tulkas in the mouth, in payment of that buffet long ago, but the Valar had foreseen something of this, and did but make play of humiliation, that Melko might thereby be lured from his stronghold of Utumna. In sooth, Manwe hoped even to the end for peace and amity, and the gods would at his bidding indeed have received Melko into Valinor under truce and pledges of friendship, had not his pride been insatiate, and his obstinacy in evil unconquerable. Now, however, was scant mercy left for him within their hearts, seeing that he abode in his demand that Manwe should do homage and Tulkas bend to those ruthless feet. Nonetheless, the lord of gods and elves approaches now the chair of Melko and makes to kneel, for such was their plan, the more to ensnare that evil one. But lo, so fiercely did wrath blaze up in the hearts of Tulkas and Aule at that sight, that Tulkas leapt across the hall at a bound, despite Angaino, and Aule was behind him, and Orome followed his father, and the hall was full of tumult. Then Melko sprang to his feet, shouting in a loud voice, and his folk came through all those dismal passages to his aid. Then lashed he at Manwe with an iron flail he bore, but Manwe breathed gently upon it, and its iron tassels were blown backward, and thereupon Tulkas smote Melko full in his teeth with his fist of iron, and he and Aule grappled with him, and straight he was wrapped 30 times in the fathoms of Angaino. Then said Orome, "Would that he might be slain! And it would have been well indeed, but the great gods may not yet be slain." Note 4. Now is Melko held in dire bondage and beaten to his knees, and he is constrained to command all his vassalage that they molest not the Valar. And indeed the most of these, affrighted at the binding of their lord, fled away to the darkest places. Tulkas indeed dragged Melko out before the gate, and there Aule set upon each wrist one of the Vorotemna, and upon each ankle twain of the Ilterendi, and Tilkal went red at the touch of Melko, and those bands have never since been loosened from his hands and feet. Then the chain is smithied to each of these, and Melko borne thus helpless away, while Tulkas and Ulmo break the gates of Utumna and pile hills of stone upon them. And the saps and cavernous places beneath the surface of the earth are full yet of the dark spirits that were prisoned that day when Melko was taken, and yet many are the ways whereby they find the outer world from time to time, from fissures where they shriek with the voices of the tide on rocky coasts, down dark waterways that wind unseen for many leagues, or out of the blue arches where the glaciers of Melko find their end. After these things did the gods return to Valmar by long ways and dark, guarding Melko every moment, and he gnawed his consuming rage. His lip was split, and his face has had a strange leer upon it, since that buffet dealt him by Tulkas, who even of policy could not endure to see the majesty of Manwe bow before the accursed one. Now is a court set upon the slopes of Tanik.